Okay, this the topic of this lecture is on political entrepreneurship and how it's different from real entrepreneurship or market entrepreneurship. And I think in understanding political economy, I think it's very useful to understand these differences between what we call market entrepreneurship, a real entrepreneur, and there have been some lectures discussing this week already, and what you might call a political entrepreneur. A market entrepreneur is someone who makes money by pleasing consumers. Of course, there are theories of entrepreneurship by Mises and Kirzner and other Austrian school economists. But a private sector market entrepreneur is someone who makes money by pleasing consumers, who is alert to opportunities to fill in gaps that other entrepreneurs have not noticed, by getting goods to market faster than other people, by creating new products, by innovating. And of course, most of them fail. Most small business startups fail, but failure is a good thing in that in a society that allows the freedom to fail is always more successful economically than a society that hinders the freedom to fail. Because, the freedom to fail means the freedom to try, too, when no one is omniscient. And so basically that's what a market entrepreneur is. It's making money the old-fashioned way versus a political entrepreneur. A political entrepreneur is somebody who makes money essentially by using the state in some way to use its coercive apparatus to rob and plunder one group for the benefit of himself or his group. That's essentially what a political entrepreneur is. And so the economic processes of the two types of entrepreneurs are very different. In the first hand, with a market entrepreneur, you have wealth being created. That's what creates wealth. When we talk about capitalism, and then your economics textbooks talk about how under capitalism in markets, goods are reallocated to their most highly valued uses by consumers. That's one of the things you're taught in every first chapter or two of a microeconomics class. Well, who is it that does this moving of goods to more highly valued uses? Well, it's the entrepreneur. That's how this happens, and it's capital markets that are the essence of this. Capital markets is how capital gets disinvested from bad ideas and reinvested into good ideas. I used to have a picture, a cartoon, a Gary Larson cartoon on my office door. Most of the students probably have never heard of Gary Larson, but he's retired for many years now. He was a cartoonist, and he specialized in sort of animal cartoons and it was kind of funny. It was always something. There was always something under the bed or in the closet of his bedroom or something like that. But the cartoon I had in my office was a caveman, a prehistoric caveman, and he had a sort of a lemonade stand set up. It looked like a little makeshift lemonade stand, and there was a very disgruntled customer walking away, apparently very unhappy with what he bought from the stand. The caveman standing behind it there, And the caption that I put the caption on the cartoon. It said, "Early examples that the market works." And the disgruntled customer was a person that was walking away, pulling porcupine quills out of his face. Porcupine quills. And the lemonade stand was not a lemonade stand. They were selling porcupine on a stick. And so this was an early caveman era entrepreneur who had an idea. He tried it out. Didn't work. The guy left. And I was sort of teaching the students who walked by my office a little lesson that this is a valuable thing for freedom to have, the people to have the freedom to experiment like this in entrepreneurship. But of course, it doesn't always work out that way. But think of all the great things we have that do work out, all the gadgets that you students all have in your pockets and on your desks and just about everything. It's the work of some entrepreneur. If you want to get a chuckle, go online and search for picture of Microsoft founders. I don't have a computer here with me, but you'll get a good laugh because Bill Gates, the richest man in the world, looks like, boy, Hollywood really missed out when they didn't cast him in Revenge of the Nerds. His ears look to be about this big, even bigger than Obama's. He looks about 5 years old in the picture. And when I talk about the Microsoft antitrust case in some of my classes, I tell them I'm going to show you the big businessmen who toppled IBM in the 1980s. And I put up that picture of Bill Gates and his 20-year-old, 22-year-old friends who pretty much were the founders of Microsoft back then. So look it up if you're interested. It's very funny. And so those are the differences. Now, the political entrepreneur, so market entrepreneurship is how wealth is created. Political entrepreneurship is destructive of wealth because there's a diversion of activity away from invention, investment, work, science, R&D, all the things that go into creating and producing and marketing products. If you're engaged in political entrepreneurship, like lobbying the legislature for some favor, you're not doing that. By definition, there are only 24 hours in a day. So what are you doing? You're spending your time trying to transfer money out of one person's pocket into your pocket, and in return, they get nothing. You see, with market entrepreneurship, the only way I can get more money in my pocket is to give you something that you like. My favorite phrase from The Wealth of Nations is, I can paraphrase it, is Adam Smith describing markets as, give me what I want, and I will give you what you want. That's capitalism in the eyes of Adam Smith in his book, The Wealth of Nations. Okay. In politics, though, it's give me what I want, money, and you can go to you know where in terms of the consumer. Okay. It's plunder, it's robbery, is basically what political entrepreneurship is. And the more and more people engage in political entrepreneurship, the poorer the whole country gets because we're not producing things. This might manifest itself in more and more students going to school and majoring in pre-law or communications or something like that and hoping to work in government to be a lobbyist or some sort of associated with the whole process of political entrepreneurship, and fewer students majoring in engineering and accounting and economics and business and things that are at least related to production, productive activities, as opposed to transfer activities. There's an economist named Mansur Olson, M-A-N-C-U-R is how he spelled his first name. He passed away a few years ago, who wrote several books on this topic. And in his speeches, he used to give a sort of an analogy to this difference between productive market entrepreneurship and political entrepreneurship, what some people call rent-seeking. In the literature on economics, it's basically called rent-seeking. I prefer plunder-seeking. It's a bit more accurate term. But the image that Mansur Olson gave was, imagine this, two Japanese sumo wrestlers. You know, they get these guys with great big bellies, and they put them in diapers, and they wrestle around a circle. And if you can outbelly the other guy and knock him out of the circle, I guess you win. You win the sumo wrestling match. And imagine them doing a sumo wrestling match in a china store that sells fine china and goblets and glass, and they knock over all the shelves and everything. Everything breaks, but the winner gets to walk out with the one goblet that didn't get smashed during the wrestling match. Okay, he wins, yeah. He walked in there. He did not have a $1,000 goblet in his possession. He walks out with a $1,000 glass goblet, but they might have destroyed $100,000 worth of other goblets, other glass. That was Mansur Olson's sort of image of the economic impact of the shift away from market entrepreneurship to political entrepreneurship, wealth destruction. Wealth destruction, we busy ourselves with plundering our neighbors. And I want to give two examples of this from history. This is from one of my books. This is my book on how capitalism saved America. It was published a few years ago. And there's a stark contrast between one man, James J. Hill, who built a privately funded transcontinental railroad in the 19th century. And Hill, in his autobiography, boasted that he didn't receive a penny in government aid to build a transcontinental railroad. He and his business partners raised money in the capital markets. They paid the Indians for rights of way through their land with livestock or sheep or money, whatever they could trade for, whereas the government-subsidized railroads simply called in the army to kill all the Indians whenever they were, and a lot of non-Indians, too. But here's an example, a great little book called Entrepreneurs Versus the State, published by Burton Folsom, that talks about Hill. And here's how he describes James J. Hill's market entrepreneurship and building his railroad. He said, Hill's quest for short routes, low grades, and few curvatures was an obsession. In 1889, Hill conquered the Rocky Mountains by finding the legendary Marias Pass. Lewis and Clark had described a low pass through the Rockies back in 1805, but later no one seemed to know whether it really existed or, if it did, where it was. Hill wanted the best gradients so much that he hired a man to spend months searching western Montana for this legendary pass. He did in fact find it, and the ecstatic Hill shortened his route by almost 100 miles. And so that's the sort of thing James J. Hill was about. He, no stone left unturned in cost-cutting, so he could have the cheapest route to the Pacific Ocean from the American Northwest. And if you ever read about him, he was quite an ingenious person in doing that. Now, compare this to the methods of the government-subsidized railroads that Hill was competing with. And they got governments a per-mile government subsidy. Think of that. You're building a railroad, and the government says, we will pay you for every mile track. And so a political entrepreneur, here's what James J. Hill was doing. So here's Iowa, let's say, and here's California over here. So James J. Hill is winding a route somehow to the West Coast. Here's the government subsidized railroad starting here. And their route to the coast is more like that because they get paid by the mile. It's like people who say, I get paid by the hour, so I don't care what I'm doing. You know, the more hours, the better. Well, if you get paid by the mile, the more miles, the better. And so here's a description by Burton Folsom of a man named Grenville Dodge, was the chief engineer of the government-subsidized Transcontinental Railroad. He says, since Dodge was in a hurry, build as many miles as you can, pocket as much money as you can. He laid track on the ice and snow. Imagine that, like in the Rocky Mountains, there would be a 10-foot snowpack. They would build railroad tracks on top of it. Naturally, the line had to be rebuilt in the spring when the snow melted. What was worse, unanticipated spring flooding along the lower fork of the Platte River washed out rails, bridges, and telephone poles, doing at least $50,000 damage in the first year. No wonder some observers estimated the actual building cost almost three times what it should have been. And then he goes on to explain how the people associated with the government-subsidized transcontinentals, the political entrepreneurs, went about their sort of daily business. Instead of doing things like, here's James J. Hill hiring an engineer to go and find the pass through the Rockies that Lewis and Clark had found 70 years earlier, here's what the people associated with political entrepreneurship did. Here's how they spent their days. In 1866, Thomas Durant wined and dined 150 prominent citizens, including senators and ambassador and government bureaucrats, along a completed section of the railroad. He hired an orchestra, a caterer, six cooks, a magician, perhaps to pull subsidies out of a hat, and a photographer. For those with ecumenical palates, he served Chinese duck and Roman goose. The more adventurous were offered roast ox and antelope. All could have had an expensive wine, and for dessert, they had strawberries, peaches, and cherries. After dinner, some of the men hunted buffalo from their coaches. Durant hoped that all would go back to Washington, inclined to repay the Union Pacific for its hospitality. And so that's political entrepreneurship, pretty much wining and dining politicians so that offering them shares of stock, by the way, in the company, and then in return for their vote for subsidies. And so the consumer is totally out of it. He's just being looted there for the benefit of these companies, and the politicians have their careers financed by the looters. That's the game. That's political entrepreneurship. And so what political entrepreneurship does, in essence, is to replace consumer sovereignty with the whims of politicians. You know, what gets built, what gets made, what gets subsidized is not based on consumer demand or consumer sovereignty, to use another economics phrase, but the whims of politicians. And the whims of politicians have one overriding purpose: getting themselves elected and reelected. That's the purpose. That's the ultimate purpose in society, in the eyes of most politicians, getting reelected. And which may have nothing whatsoever to do with the welfare of you as a consumer, okay? And another example I'd like to talk about of political entrepreneurship was reminded to me by Bob Higgs once. I don't know who you all have probably listened to Bob Higgs already this week. He once told me that the main reason why the government allows us to have free speech is that it really doesn't matter. They do whatever they want, no matter what we say anyway. And there's a lot of truth to that. And here I have some statistics about this. And the statistics I want to show you have to do with congressional incumbent reelection rates. If you want to get a close look at these, just go online and type in congressional incumbent reelection rates, and you'll get all kinds of data. The actual, the first thing that will pop up is this, but it's too tiny for you to see. Anyway, these are bar charts. On the top one is the House of Representatives. The bottom one is the United States Senate. And at the top of these bars, these numbers are all in the high 90s, 97%, 98%, 98.9%, the whole way from 1964 to 2008 was the last date of that. And I wrote down some of the actual numbers here. Not all of them, because it's just too much. But to give you an idea of, if you're an incumbent in Congress, you know, these are the re-election rates. Even in 2010, with the big Tea Party protests against big government, it's still 87% of all incumbents were reelected, and so for all practical purposes, once you're elected to Congress, you can stay there forever if you want. There's no challenger ever has a chance in hell to reseat you, no matter what. I can remember 20 years ago, Barney Frank, the congressman from Massachusetts, there were front page news about him in the Washington Post for a whole week because his partner had been running a male prostitution ring out of the basement of Barney's townhouse on Capitol Hill. And Barney succeeded in convincing everyone that he knew nothing about it. And, of course, he was reelected 10 times or 12 times after that. So you can even run a whorehouse out of your house as a member of Congress, and nothing will happen to you. I grew up in Pennsylvania, and there was a congressman named Congressman Flood near there. I forget his first name, but he looked like, if you ever saw the old Rocky and Bullwinkle cartoons, the younger students who have never seen Rocky and Bullwinkle, go online and see Rocky and Bullwinkle. He looked just like Snidely Whiplash, the bad guy. So go online and type in Snidely Whiplash. He was the bad guy. And Snidely had a handlebar mustache, a big black hat, almost like a witch's hat, and a cape, a black cape. And that is exactly how Congressman Flood dressed. He wore a cape. He's a member of Congress. He walked around Congress with a cape, black cape, and a big handlebar mustache with a wax on it. And he was convicted of a felony. And the Pennsylvania law at the time said that it was under appeal. So if it was under appeal, he could still run for re-election in Pennsylvania. And so he ran for re-election and got re-elected. And I remember reading newspaper articles by reporters saying, why did you vote for this guy? He's obviously a crook. He's been convicted of a felony. And the routine answer was, well, they're all crooks, but at least our crook is really good at bringing back the highway grants and the grants for new post office buildings and all that. So why not? They're all crooks. We're just going to elect another crook anyway. So that was the attitude, and that's true. That's very true. So how do they do that? So in the Senate is kind of similar. These are the numbers for the Senate, the United States Senate, congressional incumbent reelection rates. They're all pretty high also. And so the main trick that is used to guarantee that you never lose your seat once you're elected is gerrymandering. Now, this word is a combination of a man's name, Eldridge Gerry, and salamander. It is. That's the origin of this word, gerrymandering. Salamander. And Eldridge Gerry was in early America, a politician in early America. And what gerrymandering has to do with is redrawing congressional districts. Like, for example, let's say this is the state of Alabama. Okay. And let's say there are 6 congressional districts in the state of Alabama. Well, one way to decide how they're drawn is like this. 1, 2, 3. Okay. Okay, so let's say Alabama has 6 members of Congress. That's one way of doing it. That's one way of deciding what the districts look like. But that's not how it is done. How it is done is, here's Alabama, And let's say they decide that this district right here, is 90% Democrat, and then this district over here is 90% Republican. Those will be two of the districts. So the two parties will make sure that whoever runs here is a Republican will always forever be elected, and whoever runs here as a Democrat will always forever be reelected. And I printed out from online, here's a the 10 most contorted congressional districts from online. Here's one of them in Texas. That's the shape of a congressional district in Texas. I guess they call that the most distorted. Here are three more examples of how congressional districts are drawn. And so the politicians do this for the reason I just gave you. Yeah, look at this one here. Let's see if there's some more. I got a couple more here. Here's some more. Congressional districts. And so gerrymandering pretty much is an ironclad guarantee that the parties will always control the seats. And the only competition there really is they can redistrict every 10 years. And so whoever happens to be the governor at that time gets to redistrict not all, but some of the districts from time to time. And so every once in a while you'll get a Republican district that'll be redrawn as a Democrat district. But it's still the same result, that then it's true that the Democrat will never get unseated. So it's the game is the incumbents never get unseated. And that's not the only thing. Another thing is that members of Congress employ, each of them employs dozens and dozens of staff members who are essentially full-time campaigners for them. They're full-time campaigners for their boss's job and therefore for their job. And so challengers have a tough time. Challengers have to raise money and pay people to work for them or rely on volunteers. But the incumbents have professional campaigners that are called staffers. I noticed one of the books that caught my eye browsing the bookshelf downstairs was a book called Hill Rat that I had read a long time ago. It is about the Capitol Hill staffers. If you want to read a very entertaining book about what goes on Capitol Hill. I know my student, Peter Coyne, is he in here? He's a Hill Rat right now. He's actually working on Capitol Hill as a Hill Rat, as a staffer. But this explains what they do. They're essentially campaigners for the incumbents. Another reason for this result of never losing your seat is that there's been a huge proliferation of congressional committees. And so if you're from a farm state, you'll get on all the dozen or more committees that are involved in dishing out subsidies to farmers. That's why there are hundreds and hundreds of programs that just give money away to farmers for doing nothing. One of my articles on Mises.org several years ago was called Farmed Robbery. And it was about a USA Today article about cotton farmers in Texas. And that happened to be the biggest year ever for cotton production. And so the laws of supply and demand tell you that the price of cotton is going way down. And you would normally think that, well, that's good news. Jeans will be cheaper. You know, towels will be cheaper. Cotton is dirt cheap now. No, there's a government program that says the price of cotton can never go below 58 cents a pound. It can go below 58 cents a pound. But if the cotton farmers in the free market have to sell their cotton at, say, 28 cents a pound, the government will reimburse them with taxpayers' dollars for the difference between 28 cents a pound and 58 cents a pound, so that de facto they never get less than 58 cents a pound for cotton. And this article was about this guy from Texas, a farmer, cotton farmer, who had a very big smile on his face. He was like a half a page in USA Today, a big smile from ear to ear. And why the smile? You read the article. Well, he just got a check for $400,000 from the government for doing nothing. And no consumer or customer of his got an ounce of cotton in return for the $400,000. The price of cotton wasn't dropped a penny for that. It was just this government program that he and other cotton farmers had lobbied for successfully. And the fact that if you're an economics student, you might surmise that, well, maybe jeans will be maybe a couple bucks more expensive, but nobody knows that. Who knows that? An economics student would figure that out. But then even if you do know that, what are you going to do about it? Nothing. To change that, you'd have to get literally persuade a majority of Congress to quit taking bribes from cotton farmers. That's not going to happen. You don't have that kind of money, and so nothing ever happens. Another tool that is used is congressional hearings. The hearings are a way in which politicians can get free television exposure. You know, an incumbent, if I were to challenge Barney Frank in Massachusetts, and I send out a press release saying, I'm holding a press conference this afternoon, no one would show up. What do they care? But Barney, you know, gets all dressed up in his suit and stands in front of 60 or 70 American flags like they always do when they do these things. Yeah, the whole media would be there to hear his latest belch, whatever it might be, or you know, pick your member of Congress. And so that's another big advantage. The challengers can't challenge that. It's very difficult for them to challenge that. And that's another ingredient of political entrepreneurship, and it guarantees that the whole process of political entrepreneurship goes unabated, that it is never disturbed when this happens. Another trick that I'll mention is log rolling. So I have an example here somewhere. And another thing, and this has been, you know, people have known about this for hundreds of years, not this particular example. And this is an example of log rolling. And these are the A, B, and C. Let's say there's a community of three distinct groups with political preferences for either schools or hospitals. So we're talking about local government here. And let's say there's group A. This might be people with children of school age in the community. And they are in favor, their genuine preferences are, they're willing to be taxed more and have government spend more money on schools, but they don't care about more hospital spending. So some people, there might be, say, older people in the community who would vote for a referendum to build another wing to the hospital, to the local hospital run by the county, because they'll be using it. But their kids are out of school, so they don't want to be taxed more for school. Their kids are out of school. So group B is people, the older people, who would vote for more hospital spending by the government, but no more school spending. Their kids are out of school. Then there's group C, and they think the status quo is okay, so they would vote for no more of either. They wouldn't vote for either. And so the question is, if you held a referendum, which is how these spending increases occur, on raising taxes somewhat for more spending on schools, could you get a majority? You know, you need two out of three. Could you get a qualified majority, two out of three, if you had a referendum on raising school spending here? Who would like to venture a guess? What's that? I'm not asking about conniving or collusion. I'm just saying if we took a vote, and these are the preferences, and we took a vote today without any collusion or conniving going on. The answer is no. Yes, no. You'd get group A would vote for more schools, but B and C would vote no. So you wouldn't have it. And the same thing for B. If you have a referendum on hospital spending, you'd get one third of the people would vote for more hospital spending, but then A and C would vote no. And so so the genuine preferences of the community would lead to the status quo, no more spending on anything. But of course, what log rolling is what you were referring to, I guess, is the representative of group A could go to the representative of group B and say, listen, we don't give a crap about hospital spending, but we'll vote for it if, when the vote comes next month for more school spending, you vote for more school spending, even though we know you couldn't care less about school spending. And so they'll each hold their nose and vote yes for the things they don't really care about in order to get what they want, what they do care about. And that's log rolling. And so the end result of log rolling is that even though the genuine preferences of the community are no more spending on anything, the end result is more spending on everything, schools and hospitals. And that's political entrepreneurship. And of course, the economic point to be made here is that every dollar the government spends crowds out private entrepreneurial activity in some way or another, whether by somebody. It takes money out of the private sector one way or another, and rather than individuals, families, private businesses spending the money, government bureaucrats and politicians spend the money. And so the growth of government is enhanced by the process of log rolling. And there are many other tricks. You're not going to teach a whole semester's course on this. A lot of it is in the public choice literature in economics. Another trick is what the public choice economists call agenda control. And this has to do with having control over how votes are structured, how the votes are administered in elections. And I'll just give you one anecdote, a personal anecdote to explain how this sometimes works. I lived in Buffalo, New York many years ago, and I only lasted 1 year. That was enough for me. It began snowing in October and quit in May. Referenda on school spending and been turned down every three or four times. The community said, no, we're taxed enough for government schools. We don't want it anymore. And so the government in charge of the election said, well, okay, no school buses. We're going to have to cut out school buses. And this was in November in Buffalo, New York, where the snow is already piled up over the sidewalks. So they're pretty much saying your kids are going to have to walk to school in the street in the dark in the snow if you vote no. And then they took a fourth vote, and sure enough, they voted yes. So if you can control how the votes are taken, you can always win. You can always win. Another trick that's related to this is called the Washington Monument Syndrome. And the reason why it's called that is in the 1960s, the National Park Service wanted a big budget increase, and the president will not go along with it. And so the head of the National Park Service shut down the Washington Monument, which is the most popular tourist attraction in Washington, D.C. And why the Washington Monument, of all the things, shut down? Well, there are tourists from every state in America who go to Washington on a vacation, and they want their kids to worship the shrines there. And it's sort of like if you ever see people who go to Jerusalem on a trip or to Mecca if you're Muslim. Most Americans don't do that. We're not particularly religious, but we go to Washington, D.C. That's where our shrines are. We go there. They shut it down. And so members of Congress from every single state got all these nasty letters. It's my 1 week vacation and I looked forward all year to go to the Washington Monument. And it was closed down when we got there. And sure enough, he got his budget increase. Because of all the complaints to members of Congress. And so that has become very routine. Whenever the state and local governments, hesitate voting for more and more tax increases, they always cut out ambulance services, the police, the garbage collection, all the things that will inflict the maximum discomfort on the public. And there's never any talk about any waste or abuse or fraud. Government is always assumed to be operating at a super efficient level, like all those TV shows on television where the government cops and the government lawyers and they're always super efficient, they're geniuses and never make a mistake. That's what we're supposed to believe. And so that's agenda control. Some other tricks I'd like to talk about is, I'll mention the very first book I ever published was this one. It's called Underground Government, the Off-Budget Public Sector, co-authored with James Bennett. And it was about how politicians respond to tax revolts. And this was published way back in 1983 when I was 2 years old, there was a tax revolt in the late 70s in a lot of states, not just California, but in a lot of states. And so we wrote this book about how governments responded to tax revolts, and because a lot of people were just assuming that, well, if the people demand tax cuts and spending limitations, borrowing limitations, well, the government's going to have to do it. And that just didn't sound right to us, that the government would just sit back and take it like that. And so sure enough, we discovered that for well over 100 years, what governments have done would say, okay, the people have spoken, they have voted no on our tax increase, That's the way it's going to be. And then they set up off-budget government enterprises and borrow money that does not require voter approval on the bond markets and spend the money anyway with all sorts of bogus promises that they're going to make money on some shady enterprise that'll supposedly pay off the bonds, but they never do. And I'll give you one example. The king of all this was the late Nelson Rockefeller, the governor of New York, who passed away. He was found in bed with his a young woman who he hired to take care of his art collection. For those of you who have never studied Rocky, know anything about Rocky, that's how Rocky met his demise. But anyway, he was governor, and he went on. I'm reading from my own book. When voters rejected a $100 million housing bond issue for the third time, Governor Rockefeller created the Housing Finance Authority, which issued massive amounts of non-guaranteed debt, at one point in excess of the entire guaranteed debt of New York State. So this debt is called non-guaranteed debt, which means it's not backed up by anything. Guaranteed debt in the language of government means when the government borrows, the principal and interest will be paid back out of tax dollars. But if it's non-guaranteed, and the government says, we're going to build public housing projects, and we're going to rent them, and the rent will be used to pay off the principal and interest. It's never enough, though. They always end up dipping into the treasury to pay these off, so they lie. To continue, in 1961, voters rejected a $500 million higher education bond issue for the fourth time. The governor created the off-budget State University Construction Fund. In 1965, the voters rejected for the fifth time a housing bond issue. The governor created the Urban Development Corporation. In 1962, by 1962, there were 125 of these. And it's not just Rockefeller. It's every state in the United States that plays this game. They set up these entities called authorities or special districts or something like all kinds of names, and that's the game. And that's political entrepreneurship. And so, you know, another aspect in terms of the economics or the political economy of political entrepreneurship, it's market entrepreneurship is all about catering to consumers. That's how you make money. That's how Bill Gates became so rich, is giving the consumers what they want. That's how John D. Rockefeller became so rich, giving consumers cheaper and cheaper and cheaper refined petroleum. But political entrepreneurs prosper by isolating themselves from consumers and voters, by being able to do whatever the hell they want to do, to use scientific language, without being bothered by anybody. There's no stock market discipline. There's no consumer discipline. Nothing. They do whatever they want, like the congressional incumbents. But so that's what political entrepreneurship is all about. And off-budget government spending is one way of doing this. And this, by the way, has led to some financial catastrophes in America. At the time Jim Bennett and I wrote this book, there was a it was in the middle of the largest bankruptcy in the history of municipal finance in America. And there was something called WHOOPS, Washington Public Power Supply System. There's two S's there. They started building five nuclear power plants off budget by selling these bonds. And, of course, the Wall Street bond traders were happy to make the commissions and sell the bonds. And the politicians always would give them a wink-wink, meaning we'll come up with the money with these bonds. Yes, they're not legally guaranteed. In fact, they even hired Nixon's lawyer, Mitchell, the former attorney general who went to jail. He was a bond counsel in New York City at the time, to invent something called the moral obligation bond. And so what Mitchell said was that, well, yes, these bonds do not have a legal obligation by the government to pay off principal and interest, but the politicians have a moral obligation to pay it off. And that was enough. That was sort of a wink-wink to the investors that you'll get your money. You know, buy these bonds and they'll pay you 19% interest and you're not going to lose your money. Well, they did lose their money. WHOOPS went bankrupt. And after, I think they lost, at the time, I think it was $3 billion down the tubes, and they didn't finish any of the nuclear power plants. Another book that I wrote with Bennett that touches on political entrepreneurship is this one, Official Lies, How Washington Misleads Us. It's not nearly big enough as it should be. If you see how thick it is, you could have written a very thick book about the size of this room on that. But our marketing strategy is to write books that people will actually read. You know, if you wrote a book this big, nobody's going to read it. And so, one of the basic ideas here in terms of political entrepreneurship is that government really does have the ability to drown out most other voices when it enters into a debate on almost anything. Now, the internet has really disrupted all of this since we wrote this book. That's why you occasionally hear Senator Lieberman or somebody like that proposing to shut down the internet in case of emergency. And they really hate the idea that the internet is out there and that we can communicate without gatekeepers. So things have changed dramatically. But basically, the government lies to us about just about everything. I'll show you the list of chapters that we chose. As students, chapter 9 would probably be your favorite, I would imagine. It's called Dope, Booze, Smokes, and Sex. Chapter 9. But to give you, I'm running out of time here, but to give you some examples of government lying for the purpose of expanding its own powers at the expense of the private sector, this is a table we put in here. Maybe somebody in the front row can read it. But this is a table of rhetoric and reality of what the federal government has said about oil supply in the United States. From the moment oil was discovered in Pit Hole, Pennsylvania, in the United States, the government began predicting we're going to run out any day unless we nationalize the oil industry. They wanted to take it over. And so here's 1885, the U.S. Geological Survey said there's little or no chance of oil in California. They've pumped 8 billion barrels since then. 1891, the government said little or no chance of finding oil in Texas or Kansas. 1908, the government said maximum future domestic supply of oil is 22 billion barrels. Well, 35 billion barrels have been pumped since then. 1914, they said total future domestic production, 5.7 barrels. It was 34 billion after that. 1920, the U.S. needs foreign oil and synthetics. Peak domestic production is almost reached. So we pretty much used up all the oil by 1920, they said. And so that's the sort of thing that we write about in this book, and it's all a part of political entrepreneurship. And we have a chapter on farming, large corporate farms being the major recipients of farm subsidies, although the government wants you to think that it's Ma and Pa Kettle standing there with the pitchfork in that famous picture who are receiving farm welfare. No, it's large corporations. They're receiving the farm welfare. And so one other book I could mention, but I'm not. I'll mention a book by somebody else for a change. This is another great book on this general topic of political entrepreneurship, Money for Nothing by Fred McChesney. And what this is about is the phenomenon, and Fred McChesney is a fellow traveler of the Austrian school. He wouldn't call himself an Austrian economist, but he's a real solid free market economist and legal scholar. He teaches law at Northwestern University. He's a law and economics scholar. And this book is published by Harvard University Press. And what it's about is basically legalized extortion. You notice there's a whole broad range of government regulations and legislation that where there seems to be no identifiable special interest group that wanted them. And so why does this come about? Usually we get laws because there's some organized group that lobbies for the laws, but these ones have just come out of Congress themselves. Congress throws these things out. Nobody lobbied for them. Where do these come from? Well, Professor McChesney got to the bottom of it. And what he found out is that this legislation on Capitol Hill, the Hill rats call them milker bills, milker as in milk that you drink, milker bills. And what are they doing? They're milking campaign contributions from corporations, mostly. And for example, during the Clinton administration, they started proposing price controls on pharmaceuticals. In 1 year, the pharmaceutical industry gave $3 million to the Democrat and Republican parties, and then Washington said, oh, forget about it, we were just kidding. They withdrew the proposal to have price controls on pharmaceuticals. Or they'll propose an onerous tax just on your industry, and so you must respond by sending money to the politicians in Congress who propose or are threatening to support this onerous tax that might even drive you into bankruptcy, and then they withdraw the legislation. And so the Hill staffers call these milker bills, sometimes they call them juicer bills, that they sort of juice the campaign coffers of their bosses by getting this legislation written up that has no benefit other than extorting money from different groups, mostly corporations, because that, after all, is where the money is, isn't it? And so I would recommend money for nothing. So all of this is political entrepreneurship, the evils of political entrepreneurship, to show you the evils of the politicization of society. In fact, that's the title of one of Hayek's books that was written many years ago, The Politicization of Society. And Hayek would be horrified if he really was alive, still alive today, and observing the extent to which these warnings of his way back 50 years ago went unheeded and have gone sort of unabated today. And so I guess on that enlightened note, I have 11 o'clock, and I think my time is up. Maybe I'll have time for one question. Or do I have to 11:15? Okay, well, I'll keep blabbering then. I thought it was 11. Okay. I thought I had to 11. Good thing we have a math major. Good thing we have a math major in the back. Well, I'll make one more point then, and we'll have a Q&A if you want. But don't ask me questions about Walter Block's theory of abortion or something like that. I mean, students are always come here, always want to talk about Blockian libertarian political philosophy any chance they get. I'll make one more example of political entrepreneurship then is yet another book I co-authored with Bennett called Destroying Democracy. Hold your applause, please. Destroying Democracy. The idea I got for it was from James Madison's famous essay, Federalist Paper Number 10, where he said the whole purpose of the Constitution was to control the violence of faction, and the violence of faction was democracy. If factions were special interest groups, that's democracy. So James Madison is there saying the whole purpose of this Constitution is to control democracy. Unbridled, we don't want unbridled democracy. It's because they understood it's legal plunder. Is what, you know, democracy is though, Tabor here and I walk across the car outside that belongs to one of you, and we start breaking into the car. We smash the window in, and Tabor takes the ignition thing off, and she's ready to gun the ignition, and we're going to ride off in your Mercedes. And you come upon us and say, you know, what are you doing? And this is my car. And Tabor and I will say, well, let's take a vote and decide whose car this is. There are three of us here. You know, the two of us vote. It's our car. How do you vote? Well, it's your car. We win. It's our car. That's democracy, right? That's basically democracy is a larger gang abusing, plundering, and beating up on a smaller gang. That's what democracy is. It's not what you were taught in civics class in school, if you were taught. And so the American founders understood this, and so they understood that, well, it's not as bad as dictatorship or kings. But we need to really strictly limit this stuff. We want too much of it. And so we wrote this whole book called Destroying Democracy. the subtitle is How Government Funds Partisan Politics, FUNDS, Funds Partisan Politics. And we had gathered a big database of federal government grants to all sorts of special interest groups, anything from labor unions, to the Sierra Club, to the so-called welfare rights organizations, to the neocons of the day who were at the time agitating to create the National Endowment for Democracy. And it was billions of dollars given to special interest groups who would then use the money, some of the money, not every dime of it, but some of it, to lobby government for it to spend more. Government would succeed in having more taxes and more government spending. And then it would give some more of that money back in grants to these special interest groups who would then be part of the lobbying apparatus for bigger government. Government would get bigger, it would get more money, and it would share some of that money with the same groups again in round three, and they would use it to lobby and proselytate and hire lobbyists and so forth, and that's the process. And so, and it's all illegal. You know, government knows that this is shady and immoral because it has passed numerous laws against it. And then it makes a big fuss telling the people it's illegal to use tax dollars for partisan political purposes. And at the beginning of the book, we quote Thomas Jefferson from his Virginia Declaration of Religious Liberty saying, to compel a man to contribute to a cause with which he disagrees is sinful and tyrannical. And so the politicians understood this, that if we tax one person, and you say you're anti-abortion, say you're a devout Catholic who's against abortion, yeah, how just is it to tax you, to force you with a threat of prison, which is what income tax is, to take money from you and give it to Planned Parenthood to lobby to expand the number of abortions that are taken, or take any issue, you know, that you're in favor of. Now, how just is it to tax you or and to fight against you in politics? So they've passed law. They realize that is immoral and unjust to do that. So they pass laws against it, and then they do it. So the public thinks there are laws. In fact, Bennett and I gave a talk about this at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C. at the time when the book came out. And they round, and this was in the Reagan administration, and the president of the Heritage Foundation rounded up a lot of the Reagan appointees and different from HUD and the Defense Department and the Labor Department and all. They were there to hear about this because supposedly they were going to do something about this. And so Ben and I gave this presentation, and but then what we were told by every one of these people is that, but we want careers in government. If we make a big stink over this, they'll give us a hard time, and we can't have careers in government. And these were the Reagan Republicans. So therefore, we are going to do nothing about it. And so this book was published in 1985. And it's orders, many orders of magnitude worse now. In fact, Daddy Bush greatly expanded this with his compassionate conservatism theme by giving money to churches. Remember, they started to give all sorts of money to religious organizations, and of course the churches were expected to at least implicitly support the Bush administration and get people to go out and vote for Bush, but it was given some sort of fancy title, and they put somebody in charge of that program, and then under Obama, it's the Obama type people who started this in the first place, who we wrote our book about. About 30 years ago. And so they're just going, you know, gangbusters with using tax dollars to subsidize partisan politics. And so that, again, is, as you can see, I've written quite a few books on political entrepreneurship and its destructiveness. But there's a lot more to it. Early in my career, I remember telling my old friend David Henderson, as long as government is there, I'll be in business with the kind of stuff I do, the kind of books I write. And everything. And so, because he once asked me, well, what if we succeed sometime and have limited government or small government? And I was never worried about that. I guess Gary North is not here yet, is he? Is Gary here? He speaks tomorrow, I think, or Saturday. So he's probably not here yet. But he once said that about all of this, this critiques of government interventionism, is that, like Bob Higgs said, the government allows us to have free speech because they know it doesn't matter. The way Gary once put it is that you cannot fight City Hall, but you can pee on the steps and run away. So that's sort of what I've been doing for the past 25 years, figuratively speaking, of course. Although we did do it on the statue of Keynes at Cambridge University one night, as I recall, at the Mont Pelerin Society meetings in 1984, where I met Hayek. I think the people I was with that literally did that. It was a bunch of libertarian guys at the Mont Pelerin Society meetings at Cambridge University. Okay, maybe I'll stop there. That's enough examples of political entrepreneurship, and see if anyone has any brilliant commentary or probing questions or anything like that.
I was wondering if you could talk about resistance tactics to use during an election cycle and whether it's even possible to co-opt democracy for libertarianism.
Resistance tactics. My favorite resistance tactic is not voting. And so I wrote an article on lewrockwell.com a few years ago entitled Be Patriotic, Don't Vote. And the basic argument was that, and it's not original, Lysander Spooner made the same argument, you know, in the 19th century, and people before him did too. And the basic argument is that since the government is in Washington is totally unconstitutional anyway, I mean, they pay no attention to the Constitution whatsoever, the act of voting is you are validating this lawlessness that exists in Washington, D.C., because it's only the fact that millions and millions of people vote that the politicians then say, the people have spoken, they have validated our campaign, we can socialize medical care, we can bomb Iran, and we can, you know, and all that. And, you know, when I, back when Murray Rothbard was still alive, he used to say that he wished that the foreign policy establishment in America would just bomb every other country all at once and get it all over with, get it out of their system, and then just leave us alone with all this stuff for once and for all. But today, it seems that it pretty much seems that's what they're trying to do, isn't it? It's like every day there's a new boogeyman out there. They're in Africa now. They're in Central America. There's Syria, Iran. And so, but that's all legitimized by voting, the act of voting. And so if only 5% of the people showed up, it would delegitimize the regime. So I think the regime, the whole regime has to be delegitimized. And if you think I'm exaggerating when I say they don't pay attention to the Constitution, well, several years ago, Ron Paul invited me to come down to his office and give a talk on my book, The Real Lincoln, to him and his Liberty Caucus of about a dozen or so members of Congress in his office. And being from Texas, he had a big bowl of shrimp, and each shrimp was about this big. And then I think he said they got him from next to a nuclear power plant near Houston somewhere. That's the one thing that sticks out of how Congress people live. But anyway, they all agree. These are like a dozen members of Congress that you cannot make constitutional arguments in Congress anymore against any government program. They all agree. Ron agreed with that. And all the rest of them can't do that. They laugh at you. And so why are you, when you vote, you legitimize the regime. And so I've been writing for years trying to regain the respect in the eyes of the public of the principles of nullification and secession. You know, even back when Tom Woods was a little baby, I was writing about that stuff, I think. And Tom is my great partner in that enterprise, and among others, of trying to popularize these ideas. And so that's what I would say. The heck with politics. Yes, sir.
Would political entrepreneurship toward a different end also legitimize the regime, or could it at this point be necessary to counteract the sort of political entrepreneurship that's allowed for $3 billion jokes like moral obligation bonds to be told?
Different types of, I'm not sure I get what you're
saying. Right. We've covered political entrepreneurship towards these sort of insidious ends.
Yeah.
Could there be maybe like libertarian participation in the political system? Is that a sort of
So you do see sort of exceptions that prove the rule once in a while. Like there was a mayor of Jersey City, New Jersey, several years ago that was a sort of a young retired Wall Street investment banker who didn't need the money, who privatized the water supply in Jersey City and did some good things like that. You do see that going on. That's entrepreneurship. But it's a case of sort of the exception proves the rule, that it's a general rule that we see much more of the bad entrepreneurship. But, yeah, it's not unimaginable that you wouldn't see people like doing things like this. But, like, if you're elected to Congress, though, your typical day in Congress is you might have 50 people coming in your office trying to bribe or threaten you into voting yes on spending more, and nobody ever comes in saying spend less. And so good people get worn down in the, with the lone exception of Ron Paul. I can't think of anybody else who just never got just worn down by the system like that. Did you have something else to say?
Yeah, so then is it necessary to sort of back the people that don't get worn down, and would anything else be like bringing a full bladder to a polling station?
Bringing what?
A full bladder to a polling station.
Oh, yeah. No, I wouldn't do that. I was just joking about that. But not during the voting time anyway. Yeah. Well, if you want to, I know. See, you're much younger than me, so you think this could actually work. But these students are always wanting to know the magic bullet, but there is no magic bullet with this system. That's why some of us have been writing about nullification and secession for a while. You look at the Soviet Empire, how it imploded. It imploded by over a dozen or so acts of peaceful secession. And they had some countries like Estonia that had a much greater degree of freedom than other parts of the old Soviet Empire. So they really did have sort of the American idea of federalism, of different republics trying different things. You have a big welfare state here, and you have an almost libertarian government there. at a meeting I attend every year in Turkey, Hans Hoppe's Property and Freedom Society meeting. You know, we have the Attorney General of Lithuania shows up. He's part of our group, and they were part of the Soviet Empire not too long ago, and so I think that's more promising in the long run. But if you want to engage in politics, why not? Hopefully, you make some money at it if you can do that. I think my time is up. The ghost of Mark Thornton just appeared in the door, so thank you very much.